Welcome to Mentioned in Dispatches, the podcast from the Western Front Association, with me, Dr. Tom Thorpe. The WFA is the UK's largest Great War History Society. We are dedicated to furthering understanding of the First World War and have around 6,000 members worldwide. For more information, visit our website at westernfrontassociation.com. It is the 1st of September, 2024, and this is episode 340. On today's Dispatches podcast, I talk to author and former pilot John Nicol about his latest book, The Unknown Warrior. This book is an exploration of the poignant history and enduring significance of the Unknown Warrior Memorial in Westminster Abbey. It uncovers stories of sacrifice, remembrance, and the personal and collective impact of war. It is published by Simon & Schuster, and John also has a theatre tour to accompany this book. Now, if you are listening to this podcast and it's past the 7th of November 2024, the theatre tour has ended, so do not attempt to book any tickets. John spoke to me from his home in Hertfordshire. John, welcome to the Dispatches podcast. Could we start by a brief introduction from your good self?
Thanks, Tom. Thanks for having me. My name is John Nicol. I'm a former RAF Tornado navigator. Many of your listeners might remember that myself and my pilot John Peters were shot down during the First Gulf War 33 years ago, or as my wife says, Tom, 33 years and four stone ago. I was one of those fellas paraded on TV, kind of changed my life, I suppose. I became an author. I left the Air Force in 1996, became an author, and The Unknown Warrior, which is what we're going to chat about, is my 19th book. Who'd have thought that when I was in a cell in Baghdad, in Abu Ghraib prison in 1991, that I'd be talking about my 19th book? Life deals you some pretty strange cards every now and then, my friend, every now and then.
Well, we're going to talk about your book and your tour, I gather. You'll come on to and tell us a bit more about that in a minute. Now, this is going out on the 1st of September. We're actually recording it in mid-August because we both got holiday commitments. Now, if you're listening to this in dates after probably the end of October, the tour is no longer running. Hopefully there'll be a sequel, but don't buy any tickets because you may be charged. So just with that health warning out of the way. Right, John, your book, The Unknown Warrior, delves into the deeply personal and historical significance of the Unknown Warrior in Westminster Abbey. What initially inspired you to explore this topic, and how did your own experiences as an RAF veteran influence your approach to this story?
That's a good question. So, you might know that, so as I said, it's the 19th book, and all of my previous ones have been aviation-based. So about the Spitfire, the Lancaster, the ejection seat. And I was looking for a new subject and hadn't come up with anything. And it was actually, we now go back to 2018, I think it was, yeah. And a service in Westminster Abbey, where I was with an RAF veteran, an old Bomber Command veteran. And I've been in Westminster Abbey on countless occasions, and I've seen the Tomb of the Unknown Warrior on countless occasions. But I'm embarrassed to say, Tom, I didn't know much about it, other than it was there. And this old fella, Bomber Command veteran, was telling about it, and he told me about how it came about in 1920, how the streets were packed, how it was brought, paraded through London, and how it was representing all the missing. And I was a bit embarrassed that I didn't know much about it, and I kind of thought, that's a story, there's a subject, there's a mystery for me to explore. And that's what I did. COVID and the pandemic stopped obviously anything for best part of what, 2.5-3 years. But then after that, I started exploring the story of the Unknown Warrior. Now, so a couple of things came, really smashed me in the face with the facts. And the first one was the simple idea of the death toll. Now, everybody knows that the death toll in World War I was horrendous. But what really caught me when I was reading this, the statistics, was just over 1 million British Empire soldiers killed during the First World War, and just over 500,000 with no known grave. And that really shook me. I didn't understand how so many, we can understand a few not having a known grave, but so many, just over 500,000. And that was my starting point to investigate the story. And it's apt that I should say at this point that the members of the Western Front Association were absolutely fantastic. And I mean, really generous with their time, with their knowledge, with pointing me towards articles, pointing me towards books that I should read. And so I really send my grateful thanks to the members. But that was the starting point. How did we end up with just over 500,000 men unknown? And that's how the story starts. How did that happen?
So, as he said, there's hundreds of thousands of British soldiers without a known grave. Now, these soldiers often were unidentified rather than just vanishing. So they were placed in known graves because they could not be identified. Now, what challenges did you face in uncovering these stories of these unknowns, in quote, and how did you navigate the emotional weight of such a vast and tragic history?
I mean, it's a really, really good question. So the first point was to try to work out why there were so many unknowns. And I realize that if you're embedded in the history of the First World War, you probably know some of this. But I think that the vast majority of people do not know. So how did somebody become unknown? Well, there's obviously shellfire, high explosives. And there are a number of accounts in the book where people are talking about somebody next to them, somebody near them, to a friend, a colleague, who is simply rendered ceasing to exist by high explosives. So that was one way, and that's understandable. And then another way, obviously, we've seen, especially perhaps some of the images we see of perhaps Passchendaele or the mud of the battlefields, and you can understand how the dead could be lost to the glutinous mud of the battlefields. But there's more to it than that. And so when I started to read the accounts, and they're incredibly moving. Another way was when so somebody, and it was a group account, somebody being buried and the grave is being marked. Now, this is in the midst of the battles going back and forwards. When I say buried, it's not really anything other than putting a body into a shell scrape or something like that and marking it. But then, and so somebody is recording it. But then in about 10 minutes, they are killed. The person who is recorded where the bodies are buried and where they're marked is killed. And the records are blown apart with that person. And so that's another way you lose a body. And then perhaps for me, one of the most horrific, and I just hadn't thought about this, the movement of the battlefield. So the ebb and flow of the battle. And so you could be buried, your grave could be marked, and then as the battle over the coming weeks, months, and years flows back and forwards, your grave or your graves, countless graves, could be the subject of that great shellfire again, great artillery battles, and the remains are blown out of the grave. The graves are destroyed, the remains are destroyed, and they're scattered far and wide. The ways a man could become nameless, could become unknown, were endless. And that for me was really moving, especially writing about those witness accounts. And obviously in the show, I'll be using recreations of those accounts to try to get the moving sense, the sadness, the pain of those accounts out on the stage. So for me, that was one of the biggest parts. And being an ex-serviceman, nobody wants to be buried unknown. Nobody wants to not for their loved ones not to know where you lie, where you died. And that was really important for me. And I, as I'm sure we'll come on to a bit later, try to bring the story up to date by speaking to people that it had happened to in more recent conflicts.
No, it certainly happened to my grandfather. He lost a friend, Cyril Guy Battiscombe, on the 1st of July, not at Battle of Gomancourt. And certainly he vanished, and he's on the Tietbouw Memorial. And well,
Yes,
again,
yes.
one of those things, we don't know what happened to him. He could still be there. But when I went back, I was just amazed about how short this area that they were in, and how can people just disappear? It seems unbelievable.
And that I couldn't agree with you more. When I went back, so I went back to Tietbouw, to the monument, and to look around that area around that section of the Somme, and so High Wood, Beaumont Hamel. And when you go to somewhere like High Wood, and I use again an account of somebody who was killed at High Wood, and it was the chap's friends survived the war, and he wrote about it, and he talks about, they're going over the top, so to speak, and his mate is shot and killed next to him in the midst of the charge forwards. He stops, cradles him in his arm, but is ordered forward as they were. And that was the last they saw of him. And there's no explanation about how that body was lost. He was alive. He was alive, shot, dead, body complete. He was just shot. And then at some point in the coming hours, days, nothing. Gone. Ceased to be. That's really difficult to kind of get your head around, isn't it?
It's just, yeah, I just find it difficult to humanly conceive that this is possible. That, I appreciate you might have bodies, but people don't disappear, especially when this area is full of soldiers. And
Yes.
I appreciate, and this is a one day battle, and there's never any action there again. And
Yeah.
the idea that these people just disappear, it's just amazing.
But when you look at the logistics of trying to recover the bodies, trying to bury the bodies, trying to do something with them, it was an incredibly difficult, complex task, especially as the battles could be raging nearby, in actual fact. And in High Wood, I've got I was given a picture of, so High Wood was what, 1916. And there's a picture of High Wood in 1919, so a year after the war. And there are still human remains lying around that haven't been. So 3 years later, human remains are lying in the open. These aren't buried. These aren't lost to the mud. These are just lying in amongst the trees and amongst the grass and amongst the fields. And you get there, you then begin to understand how this all unfolded, how this great, amazing, sad story unfolded.
And was there a story? I know you've looked at sort of lots of long forgotten diaries, archives, and interviews, and I know you talked to some descendants of the First World War generation in your research. Was there anything that was particularly, I suppose, emotionally impactful in your sort of adventures into this subject?
I mean, there was so much. Standing on the ground for me was immensely moving. If you fought a war yourself, and I didn't fight for very long before I was shot down, to be honest, but you do get a sense of sacrifice. You do get a sense of death. You do get a sense of the ultimate sacrifice of your friends dying. And standing on the ground at some of the major battlefields was astonishing. There was one, Tom Kettle used his story quite a bit. He was an academic, a barrister. I think he was a member of parliament over in Dublin. He was an officer in the Royal Dublin Fusiliers, and he was killed on the 9th of September 1916 during the battles. And there are accounts because there were people with him. And it talked about, yeah, he came under intense fire, and I think it says he was struck by a tempest, a hail of fire, and he went down, but he got back up again, but he was hit again and killed outright. And Tom had written his last letter. And if you know anybody in the military who's deployed into conflict, Tom, you know that we write our last letters to be delivered, and the first line of the letter is, if you're reading this, I've gone. I'm dead. And Tom wrote to his wife, talking about, said, my dearest wife, the long expected is now close at hand. I was at Mass and Communion this morning at 6 o'clock. The camp is broken up. It is no longer indiscreet to say that we are to take part in one of the biggest attacks of the war. Many will not come back. And then he goes on, and he's basically saying, if I should die, think only this of me, the famous line. And he said, there was never in all the world a dearer woman or a more perfect wife and adorable mother. My heart cries for you and Betty, that was his daughter, who I will never see again. God bless and help you. Tell Betty her daddy was a soldier and died as one. I find that moving now, just reading the damn thing out. So Tom was killed, and this helped me understand. So Tom was killed. He was buried by a detachment from the Welsh Guards, in actual fact, that buried him in the immediate aftermath. But at some point in the next days and weeks, the battle ebbed and flowed, and his grave and his marker was lost. And so again, he was buried. He was marked. We knew where he was, and at some point, gone in an instant. And Homme is one of those, what is it, just over 72,000 of the Somme alone, as you know, commemorated on the Thiepval Memorial, the missing of the Somme alone. And for me, those kind of very human stories really bring it home. Half a million is quite difficult to understand. But when you read the account of one man and then multiply that half a million times, I think you get a sense of the vastness of the story.
I know it's incredible. Now, let's talk a bit about what the unknown warrior was. It was a concept that of an unidentified soldier representing all the missing. It's both poignant. I'll start that a bit again. But so let's talk about the unknown warrior. Now, the concept of the of an unidentified soldier is that he represents all the missing, and this is both poignant and complex. How was this individual chosen, and what was the significance of that selection process, both for, I suppose, history and also families remembering lost relatives?
Yeah. So this is actually a major part of the presentation of the show to try to bring this to life. So in the aftermath of the war, obviously, first of all, nobodies or almost nobodies were returned. That was the policy at the time. They were to lie in a corner of a field that will be forever England, out of the great war cemeteries that we now know. And so there was consternation at this in various quarters because lots of people wanted their loved one home. They wanted them buried in their churchyard. They wanted them buried so that they had a grave to go and visit. So you had one group of people who wanted the bodies of the known returned, and there was another group of people who were the loved ones of the unknown who had nowhere anyway. So there's two, and both of them wanted answers. And the idea that for one man to represent all of the missing came from initially from Reverend David Railton, who was a padre who'd been on the been out in on the front lines since early 1916, and he won the Military Cross on the Somme, and we might talk about it in a minute. But I spoke to his surviving daughter-in-law, and she never even understood that he'd won the Military Cross. It was not talked about when he was alive. He never spoke. He never said one word about his wartime service. But Reverend Railton had seen in 1916, after a battle, he'd gone back to his billet and he'd come across a grave in a garden at the back of his billet. And it said in the grave was a, it was marked with a cross pencil, with a pencil mark on it. And it said, an unknown soldier of the Black Watch. And Railton wrote about this really movingly later on. And he said, he really thought about this. Who was this person? Who were his people? Who were his folk? Who were his mothers and his fathers? Who were his mothers and father? And he said he had that idea then back in 1916 to bring a body, bring that body back, bring that body back of an unknown to represent all the unknowns. Now, he said, obviously, the war was going on then. And that he thought about that idea. For the next 4 years. And he buried countless known and unknown during his time as a padre and ministered to the dead. And in 1920, when we were approaching the second armistice, so the new cenotaph was about to be unveiled, the new cenotaph that we know today, the permanent one. And Railton decided that this was the time to put his idea forward. And in the summer, he wrote to the Dean of Westminster with a proposal. He said to bring back one unknown soldier. He called it an unknown soldier, and we discussed that in a minute, to represent all the missing, to try to quench the desire for closure. We talk about closure now, but this was real closure then. And Dean Ryle, Herbert Ryle, took the idea up, presented it to the Prime Minister, who presented it to the King. There was a lot of going back and forth at first. There were some pushback. Some, the king especially didn't wasn't really sure that we should be kind of continuing with this concept of memorializing people. But eventually the idea was taken up, and in a very short space of time, it was decided that we would have a body come back from the battlefields, an unknown, to be buried. Now, Raoul called it an unknown soldier, but in actual fact, the powers that be said it should be an unknown warrior. Because if you said unknown soldier, those who had died in the Royal Flying Corps, those who had died perhaps in the Naval Division, would not be commemorated. Now, the chances are it's almost certainly an unknown soldier, but it doesn't matter. It's the concept which is important. The concept. And so the planning started to bring back one body. And the man at the helm of that was Brigadier General Louis Wyatt, from his headquarters in Saint-Paul in northern France. And the records are really very thin about what happened, how it happened. And I've read 100 articles and many books, countless articles in the Western Front Association magazines, with people having ideas about who it might be, who it might not be, who it could be, who it couldn't be. But the whole point is, the concept was that it's unknown. And that's what Railton wanted, unknown. So it doesn't matter who it was. But Louis Wyatt, General Wyatt, sent out four of his teams to bring back an unknown warrior from four of the massive battlefields. And how that happened is not really recorded. There's a couple of accounts of people who said they were there, but nothing proven. So you can only really go with what Louis Wyatt says. But the teams went out to the four battlefields. They selected somebody that had been buried unknown. And the idea was that it should just be remains. So we don't know. We don't know really if it was a bag of bones, if it was a bone, if it was a decomposing body. Again, General Wyatt says that they were brought back to his headquarters and they were placed in the temporary chapel at Saint-Paul. And he was told that they were ready. Note that the four teams didn't meet each other and they were all sent back to their own bases after that. Louis Wyatt went into the chapel at midnight on the 8th, 9th of November 1920. And he describes that there were four stretchers with the remains on the stretchers, and the remains were covered by a Union Jack. And that's more or less what we know. And he said, I selected one. Colonel Gell and I put the remains in a pine coffin, which had been brought out from the UK, and sealed the lid. And that's really what we know. We then know what happened in the ceremony. The unknown warrior was then taken the next day to Boulogne, to the castle, where the grand casket awaited. And many of your listeners will know the pictures of the grand casket made from the oak of Hampton Court. The unknown warrior was placed in the pine coffin in the grand casket, stayed overnight in Boulogne Castle, and then on the 10th, started the journey back to England. So to Boulogne Harbour, loaded onto HMS Verdun in a grand ceremony. If you look at the old pictures, it's a grand ceremony. Again, really trying to recreate the solemn nature of that parade, the grandness of that parade. Sailed across the Channel to Dover, placed in the carriage at Dover Main Railway Station, Dover Harbour Main Railway Station, in the van, in the railway carriage that Edith Cavell's remains had been taken to London in. And then it was taken to London Victoria Station, arriving on the 10th, the evening of the 10th, the night of the 10th. And of course, the Western Front Association still holds a ceremony there on the 10th to commemorate that. And that again, 104 years on, we're still commemorating that aspect of the ceremony. That's amazing. I love that so much. I think that's so important. It stayed overnight at Victoria Station, and then the grand parade on Armistice Day on the 11th, where the body was paraded through the streets of London. The cenotaph was unveiled, and then the body was taken to Westminster Abbey. Have I jumped ahead in my story here?
No, you're good. In the and the body was interred in I think the nave of Westminster Abbey, where it remains to this day. Now, probably one point of clarification that might be worth doing: what is the relationship between the cenotaph, that memorial in Whitehall, and the
Yeah,
unknown warrior?
really good question, because in actual fact, they are interlinked but very separate. So they had been at, so Armistice Day 1919, war finishes quite a 1919, there is a grand parade, a temporary structure, a temporary monument is created, the cenotaph, and it's made of wood and plaster. Cenotaph, and I didn't know that cenotaph is the Greek name of kenos, so it's empty tomb. It's cenotaph, empty tomb. That's what it means. And if you look at the cenotaph, and I've paraded at the cenotaph on more times than I can, I've got, had hot lunches, hot dinners, and I had not fully understood the significance of that empty tomb for all of the missing, or so, sorry, for all of the dead, not the missing, all of the dead. And there is a tomb on the top. There's an empty tomb on the top to represent all of the dead. And so that was 1919. And obviously, because it was wooden plaster, British weather, London weather especially, it was falling apart. And so it was going to be taken down. It was never meant to be a permanent structure. And there was an outcry. And so plans were then made for a permanent cenotaph to be built, which is the one that we know today, the permanent cenotaph, the beautiful memorial. And that was planned, and the parade to unveil that was already planned. All of those were in hand. The king was going to unveil the cenotaph on Armistice Day 2020 during the parade, during the service. But then Railton came up with this idea a couple of months before, and suddenly everything changed. We're not just going to unveil the cenotaph, which is already planned. We're going to have the tomb of the unknown warrior. And suddenly that's all now suddenly being put into the plans. The parade that, so then the unknown warriors paraded to the cenotaph, where the king places his wreath on the tomb, and then the cenotaph is unveiled, and then there's the tomb, and it sounds. And all of these things are interlinked, but the cenotaph is completely separate from the tomb of the unknown warrior. Two completely separate ideas, but interlinked in the concept of remembrance, memorialization, grief, somewhere to grieve, somewhere to pray, somewhere to remember.
That is a very good segue for the next question. Now, your book touches on the ongoing need for tangible resting places for the fallen, even in modern conflicts. How do you believe our methods of remembrance have evolved? And what lessons from the past do you think we should carry forward?
So a major part of the book and the tour is speaking to people who can help me understand what happened and the significance. So in all of my other books, I've always spoken to, so people who flew the Lancaster, people who flew the Spitfire. Clearly, that's not available. So I found people that could help me with the stories of those who had done it during the First World War in 1920. So to help me understand the concept of burying the dead unknown, I spoke to a padre who'd been fought in the Falkland Islands in 1982, and he had buried Argentinian soldiers unknown because they had no identification. And I hadn't really comprehended this. I knew it because I've been to the Argentinian grave when I've served in the Falklands, been to the Argentinian ceremony, and I've seen an Argentinian soldier known unto God on the cross. But I hadn't understood it. And he was telling me about how he, at one point, I think he buried 32 unknown, and they buried them in a trench, a water-filled trench, because the battle was going through and it was still raising. The same way that Padre Railton had done in 1916 and in 1917. And I found that incredibly moving. And to help me understand more about those who lost loved ones, I spoke to a friend of mine's widow. So he was a tornado pilot. He'd been lost. His jet had crashed at sea in the run-up to the Gulf War in 1990, and his body had never been recovered. And so she had nothing. And when his funeral took place, there was no coffin. It was his cap sitting on a table next to the Union Jack. That's what represented him. So there was no body. And his family talked about the need that they wondered what had got, where was he? What had gone on? At one point, and this happened on a couple of occasions, speaking to people like this, they said, "I wonder if he's off on a secret mission. I wonder if he's alive, and they've told us he's dead because he's carrying out some secret mission." And these are sensible people. They said, "We know it is crazy, but it's what we thought at the time." And another lady that I spoke to, her father had been killed on HMS Coventry in the Falkland Islands when it was bombed and sank. And his body was never recovered, obviously, and nothing came back from him. So everything that he had went down on the ship. So they had nothing of his. All they had was the letters that were returned after his death saying, "Sad to inform you, Petty Officer is dead, deceased." That's really quite hard, isn't it? That kind of that notification that somebody is dead. And she was telling me about how not having a grave to remember somebody to pray at really did play on the family's mind. And again, you talked about remembrance and commemoration. So if we march forward to the conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan, so lots of people forgot this, but when the first guys were being killed and the bodies were coming home, they were brought home more or less in secret under the cover of God, darkness. There were no grand ceremonies. There were no grand parades. They were flown into either Brize Norton or Lynham, and they were driven away. And there's a very famous photograph, and I remember this from mid-2000s, I think, something like that. And it's, I think it's one or two coffins stuck at the crossroads in Carterton Town, which is next to Brize Norton, next to where I lived when I was at Brize Norton for 5 years. And the picture's the crossroads, and there's two coffins, and it was front page news. How can we treat our dead like this? And things began to change. And people will remember Wootton Bassett, which is now Royal Wootton Bassett, and the grand parades. And in the book, I talk, and in the tour, I'm going to talk about this, how it started with one person bowing their head because a coffin had come through, and it was a policeman. And the coffin was stopped by a skip lorry picking up a skip. And the coffin was stopped by that. And the public just stood and bowed their heads next to the coffin, the hearse and the coffin. And it then grew to one or two people coming out to mark the passing, then members of the British Legion, then members of the family, then members of the regiment, until it came to the massive parades. And I spoke to one lady who's in the book, whose husband was killed in Afghanistan in 2009. And he was killed on the worst day of the Afghan conflict, and nine bodies came home. And she was there. And she talks about the need to have. So she's got somewhere. She's got a grave. She's got somewhere to remember him. But even then, she talked about the need to memorialize, the need to remember. And she said something really interesting to me, Tom. She said, even now, and so what is that? 2009. So that is now 15 years after her husband was killed. He still wakes up and says, "I wonder if he's dead." She turned down the chance to look at the body, which I think is the right thing because he'd been killed by an IED and everybody said you shouldn't do it. But she regrets it. And she said, "I should have looked. I should have looked to see that he was dead. Because I still wake up every now and then, not very often, and say, is he dead?" And she'll ring one of his friends, one of his mates who was there when he was killed. And she'll say, "Is he dead? Are you sure Scotty died that day 15 years ago?" That's quite moving. That's an astonishing thing to think about how we remember our loved ones and the need to have that place to go. So a grave. So Nikki's got a grave of her husband who was killed in Afghanistan. The people from the First World War had the Tomb of the Unknown Warrior. That was their place. And as one of the phrases that I use in the book was a young boy in 1920 who said, "The man in that coffin might be my daddy." And that was the point. The children were told, "That's your father." Wives said, "That's my husband." And it didn't matter. It didn't matter whether it was or it wasn't, or it couldn't be or it could be. They thought it could be. And that's the beauty about the concept of the Tomb of the Unknown Warrior.
Now, also in your book, you look at the planning of the Unknown Warrior. You know, obviously, it was a huge state occasion, and you've drawn analogies with modern ceremonies like the Queen's funeral. What insights did you gain from those who organise these significant national memorials, and how do they balance how do they balance, I suppose, tradition with the evolving needs of modern audiences with remembrance?
Very, very important. So obviously there's very little information about the parade. There's information about the numbers, who was at it, but there's very little concrete detail. So I went to the a man who would know, Garrison Sergeant Major Vern Stokes, he is the Garrison Sergeant Major of London, who is in charge of every state ceremonial occasion. So anybody in the military will know who Big Vern Stokes is. Not a man to be trifled with, the Garrison Sergeant Major, but I count him as a friend. Well, I count him as a friend. I don't know if he thinks of me as a friend, but we've shared quite a few beers before. So I went to see Vern in his office on Horscott, and we chatted about the reality. So Vern, to put into context, so Vern planned every state occasion. So obviously the Trooping of the Colour, things like that. But so he planned the Queen's funeral and the King's coronation. He's the man in charge. He has the responsibility of making sure that runs, and he plans it obviously down to the finest detail. Simple things. So he said everything has to be split second time. So one of the things, so all of the troops marching out of Wellington Barracks for the coronation. So the columns, I think, were something like 10 or 12 abreast, but you could only get, I think, four abreast out of the main entrance to Wellington Barracks. And you think, how? So then the technical detail about how you then get the form up outside is astonishing. And the concept of the pressure, because it's now something, the Queen's funeral was watched around the world, the coronation was watched around the world. Now, obviously, the Unknown Warrior's internment was not watched around the world, but there were hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands on the streets about, doing it, watching it, and it was, they wanted it to go without a hitch. So speaking to him about that aspect was absolutely revealing. And I, again, bringing the story up to date is so important for me. Another aspect. So we talked about disinterring the dead, long dead. How would you do that? There's very little detail. So I went to see Professor Dame Sue Black, who's a forensic anthropologist from Oxford University. And she has disinterred the long dead in places like Kosovo after the war. And she was telling me about the reality of digging up the dead that had been buried for 1, 2, 3 years. Now, I think it's important that we understand what it was like, because people were doing this in 1920. They were, sorry, in 1918 through to 1920. They were disinterring the scattered graves and putting them into what we now know as the Commonwealth War Grave Cemeteries. It was a horrific job. If a body had been dead for 2, 3, 4 years, that's quite horrific to collect the remains and then reinter them. And she helped me understand the brutal reality of what that was like. So finding out what it was like to do those jobs there was a major part of the project for me.
Now, in The Unknown Warrior, you highlight the enduring impact of war on those who survive, particularly in relation to their fallen comrades. How does your book address the long-term psychological effects of war, both for those who fought in the trenches and for veterans in more recent conflicts?
It's a really important point. So I'll talk about this. Obviously, during the First World War, we executed people for what was then called cowardice, what we would now understand as post-traumatic stress disorder. I know that it wasn't all cowardice, and there were some murders and some things, but as a general idea, it was battle shock, battle fatigue, shell shock, that people couldn't go on, and some people were executed. And one of the stories I use is David Railton, the padre who came up with the idea for the Unknown Warrior, ministers to a man about to be executed at dawn. And he writes about this. He writes about it in a different voice. He wrote a document afterwards called the the story of the flag by the flag. And it is his Union flag that covered the bodies when he was burying them, that covered the altar when he was doing impromptu services, that held the chalices when he was doing services for people who had either having communion or going into battle or about to be shot, executed. And his account of that is an astonishing account of the brutality and the reality of war. And I know times were different then. He was deeply affected by that. And so I talk about that. And I talk about more recent conflicts. One of the stories I tell is a current serviceman who recreated the 100th anniversary. He recreated the journey of the Unknown Warrior. It was meant to be a grand parade because of COVID, him and his wife had to do it on their own. And he talks about his experiences in Afghanistan and the effect that they had on. And we know that our servicemen and women are still affected by their experiences. And I think talking about it, understanding why, how we're affected is really, really important and an ongoing campaign and an ongoing subject that I continue to bang on about.
So, as we approach Remembrance Sunday, your book offers a timely reflection on how we commemorate the sacrifice across the ages. What do you hope readers will take away from The Unknown Warrior in terms of understanding and participating in the act of remembrance?
So I'll be at the Cenotaph on the 11th. The tour will have just finished on the 7th of November, and so I'll be with the War Widows Association that I'm help on the Saturday for their memorial service, and then I'll be at the Cenotaph on the Sunday for Remembrance Sunday. And for me, it is a really important part of our national act of remembrance, of commemoration, of recognition of sacrifice. And it's quite interesting because it's got bigger. I've been going for many years, and it's getting bigger by the year. More and more people want to go, and which is interesting because probably 20 years ago it was all Second World War generation, an occasional few of the last remaining First World War, but it was mostly Second World War. Well, that generation's dying. There are still some left, but I march with the Royal Air Force Ex-Prisoner of War Association. We used to have 10,000 members, and I think we have one now, and he's not fit enough to come to the service. So it is just we Gulf War prisoners of war who march. But for me, remembering, commemorating, acknowledging, saying thank you for your service, thank you for your sacrifice, I think those are absolutely crucial. And I hope that we will never forget the reality of what went on in the First World War, the Second World War, and all those conflicts since, which of course is what the Cenotaph now represents.
And now the time for your sales pitch. Where can
Ha!
people learn more about the book and also the tour?
So The Unknown Warrior, a personal journey of discovery and remembrance is the book. It comes out in at the last week of September, and of course you'll get them anywhere. Support your local bookshop if you can. I've just signed 5,000 copies, so your local bookshop, your independent bookseller will be able to get it. But if you must go on to any internet website, go to any big bookstore, and they'll get it. It's available anywhere. And the tour, John Nichols' The Unknown Warrior theatre tour, starts on the fourth Friday, the 4th of October, and goes all over the country till the 7th of November. So if you're listening to this after the 7th of November, don't go, because I'll not be there. And you can find details of the theatre tour, all its locations, all its venues, how to buy tickets, and the details of the book at johnnicollive.com. www.johnnicollive.com.
And I will put that in the show notes. So hopefully you can find them there. But otherwise, just Google it and I'm sure you'll find it. John, on that bombshell, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Tom. It's been an absolute pleasure. And once again, massive thanks to everybody in the Western Front Association for their support and for helping me.
You have been listening to the Mentioned in Dispatches podcast from the Western Front Association with me, Tom Thorpe. Thank you for all my guests for appearing on this edition. The theme music for this podcast was George Butterworth's The Banks of Green Willow. It was performed by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, conducted by Krish Russman, and produced by Biz Records. This recording is part of a collection of orchestral works by Butterworth performed by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales and supported by the Western Front Association. This is available from all good record stores under the record code BIS 2195. Until next time.